Welcome to Looks Like New, the radio podcast of the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. I'm Julia Martins, and today we are diving into something you might not expect: how video games are becoming a powerful force for decolonial thinking. As Chinese media increasingly reaches global audiences, we are seeing new forms of cultural exchange that challenge Western-dominated narratives, and it's happening through pixels and play. The video game industry has emerged as a crucial battleground for reimagining China-West relations, not through diplomacy or trade wars, but through the stories we tell and the worlds we build digitally. Our guest today is perfectly positioned to unpack this phenomenon. Warren Liu is developing his doctorate in media studies here at CU Boulder, but his journey to this research began in a fascinating place, studying how religions appear in video games and how players from different cultural backgrounds respond to these spiritual narratives. That foundation led Warren to a bigger question: how are Chinese cultural industries, especially video games, entering global markets and reshaping the way we think about China and the West? His research goes beyond just analyzing games from the outside. Warren's learning game design and coding himself, connecting directly with industry developers to understand how these cultural products actually get made. As both a scholar and a dedicated gamer who's active in online gaming communities, Warren brings a rare combination of academic insight and lived experience to our conversation about how play is becoming a vehicle for new forms of cultural understanding. Warren, thanks so much for joining us today on Looks Like New. Now, I have to confess something. I'm not a gamer myself and know very little about this world. But that's what I find fascinating. You don't need to be a gamer to recognize just how massive this industry has become. We're talking about an industry worth hundreds of billions of dollars globally. So as someone coming to this from the outside, I'm incredibly curious to learn from you about how this massive industry is also becoming a space for reimagining relationships between different parts of the world. Can you start by helping us understand what makes video games such a powerful medium, and what does the Chinese cultural industry look like today globally?
Oh, hi. Hello, everyone. My name is Warren, and thank you, Julia, for your wonderful introduction. So how should we start? Basically, a introduction of the video game industry and culturally. For everyone who do not know anything or basically, you know, about video games, it is basically softwares, but they were designed in labs and in education scenario, for example, in the college in the beginning, 1960s, 1970s in the Europe and America. And then in the beginning, video games are designed for training purposes, for example, militaries and other special forces. And then it becomes much more commercialized, and people start to design games with their engines that's also commercialized. And then there's players, which is the other part of the game. There's always a designer and there's always the players. They together form this video game culture, which one design the games and the other part, which is the players, they play, they contribute, they form a fan culture, and then they can also just put money in the games. For example, why there's so much billions of dollars involved in the industry, it's because so much money was put to design and so much money was put by the players to play the game. So yeah, well, that's kind of the basic background of it, but now we are seeing a new wave of video games. Why? Because the video game industry was supposed or was originated in the Europe or America, but now you see Korea and Japan, especially Japan during the 80s, and all of their video games, for example, Mario and Zelda, they come into the US and then Europe, and then it suddenly video game becomes a global culture because there is so much economic flow in between cultures and countries and players and people instead of just being regional, right? And then China, after its history of the reform and openness, opening up, which is in the 1980s, it becomes much more open to global trade and also designing different kind of tools, industries, and the infrastructures to support this kind of global trading. And one part of it is video game industry. So now we are seeing some interesting Chinese game introduced to the West. For example, Genshin Impact, which was one of my project in Masters. And then this podcast, I'm mostly going to focus on this game called Black Myth Wukong, which is the very recent video games that won an award on a very prestigious awarding platform called the Game Award. And then it's the first Chinese video game that we consider the AAA, which means a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of resources put into the games. We are seeing this global phenomenon. Not too many people are talking about it, but I think more importantly, it's talking about a new ways of interaction and relationship built between players, especially between the West and the China. And it seems to be casual, because one thing we say in the video game culture is, it's just a game, what does it matter, right? And then there's always other part of the people or the player saying, no, there's so much more inside of the games that you have to decode. There's so much more in the games that you have to understand in order to really see what the developers are saying. So yeah, video game culture is always something around the casualness of playing, but there's always some educational material inside of it. There's always some kind of criticalness and seriousness within the game. So that's why it's so worth to study it, not just the game, but also the culture, the relationship, and the people around it.
Great. And you mentioned about, you know, other waves in video game history. Can you expand a little bit on how it's that different from the Korean or the Japanese wave?
Yeah. So if you do not know about the terms, usually the Korean wave just refer to the popular culture that was really boomed after like 21st century. For example, the Korean pop, and then there's the music videos. There's also a lot of movies coming out from Korea. So it's just kind of either Korean or Japan, I just mentioned the video game introduced into America and Europe. Those kind of scenarios are mainly mentioned or studied because it's kind of popular culture initiative instead of like a global policy or like something much more political that we thought. Yes, this is also political when it becomes economical, when it becomes a trade, when it becomes the people starting to referring to each other or starting to playing each other's materials. However, I would like to say that this is a way, especially, well, Korea and Japan are very different from China. Let's just begin from there, because Korea and Japan, they have a very friendly relationship with America and the West. There was the colonial time, and there was the Korean War and the War II, which they both become part of the U.S. economy, and they become both part of the affiliates with the U.S., which in this case, China is always on the other side of the scale. That's why Korean wave and Japanese wave, or the cool Japan, they usually call that. They are referring to the other part of the world, the Orient, or the Oriental, and their culture introduced into West, becoming global culture. But still, it's just kind of an entry to how we start to understand what something different from the Western culture could contribute to our understanding of the humanness, our understanding of the human society, our understanding of cultures in different period or different locations. China just kind of, you could say that we really approximate with the Korea and Japan when we're trying to disseminate our culture to the West. For example, we will use some kind of technology, we will use some kind of words or discourses that is understandable to the Western player, to the Western audience. However, there is a very different standpoint, different from China and from Japan or Korea, because China has been portrayed as an enemy of U.S. Historically and maybe still now more than ever. So yeah, even this kind of wave of popular culture as the initiative to get to know the other part of the world is shared between Korea and Japan or China. Well, I still have to read more and argue more on that part, but I would say there is a very different political standing ground between those cases. So yeah, it's very interesting to see how China is very different when they are trying to introduce their popular culture and their traditions into the world.
Can you talk a little more about this process of opening up that China is going through?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier the reform and opening up. It's a political period. Usually we refer after Cultural Revolution, which is around 60s and 70s. After that, and the leader of the country, Deng Xiaoping, who comes up this idea of reform and opening up, basically saying that now if we want to really become strong in the globe or become strong in general domestically, we want to bring some new ideas from outside. We want to bring read more. We want to educate people. And thus we refer to as the reform and opening up because we want to introduce ourselves and get introduced by the others. So that was kind of a historical political period that kind of pushes how the trades are becoming global now in China, how the policy are becoming more open in China, and why there's so much individual creators and cases and minds introduced into the culture industries. Yeah.
And why should we pay more attention on this process, especially regarding the game industry?
Well, in general, like I said, or also you said earlier, it's billions of dollars. There's so much money involved in it for as like a usual, I could say it from a scale from to the players, to the developers and to the scholars, right? For the players, they always want to see something new, you know. They always want to see the new technology coming up to support a different showcase of animation, showcase of cutscenes, showcase of the play styles, and showcase of different grandness that they see when they are play, right? When they play. So, for somebody like players, the significance is always they want to play the better games, and that kind of drive the developers to develop better games. And that's how we see games from pixels in the 70s, 80s to now. There's something like Elden Ring or God of War where you see so big of a openness to the ground, and then this I don't know how to describe it, but you have to play it to actually understand how massive and how impressive those games are today. And yeah, very realistic, and they put, of course, when they develop it, they put so much money into it and so much effort and so much force. So you could definitely dive into the game industry and start to think about the labor forces, the technology involved, and the power inside of the industry, because there's always a huge industry, for example, the Nintendo's or From Software, which developed Elden Ring. They are huge. They are massive. They develop games in the scale of years, and all of those people working inside, they pay a lot of money and they pay a lot of effort. So you can definitely talk about labors in the game industry. You can definitely talk about the economics in the game industry. And you can also talk about other things. For example, this is very common in China to say or to describe game as There's a name. It's basically saying it's a kind of drug and it's addictive and it's not good for you. And so there is very much policy in China dedicated to the teenagers younger than 18 and telling them you can only play certain amount of or certain kind of or a certain length of the game in each weekdays or during the weekends. So there is actually law and policy involved in the game industry to make sure there's addictions, violence, and all of those topics that's very much common talked in the game industry.
So it's like a careful expansion. China wants to expand that industry, but it's doing it in a careful way regarding the youth.
I would say many historians in China or game historians in China, they're trying to map out the game industry in China, and they have noticed this kind of slowly, like expansion, you said, opening to more things, opening to new technology and opening to new forces into the game industry. And slowly, I wouldn't say slowly, because today the Chinese state, the government still do not really like game to be said as positive in the public. But they do recognize the accomplishment, like the Black Myth Wukong or like the Genshin have accomplished in the world. So they would praise those, or they would compliment those industries and companies and developers, will even give them awards or even publicly give them some announcements. However, the overall atmosphere in China basically is still do not play game too much because it's addictive and violent. I don't know how that will change in the future, but...
So let me try to understand. At the same time, China recognize the gaming industry as an avenue to spread its culture globally. It was not, it seems to not be very intentional from the beginning. And my impression is that from what you're describing is that you had the gaming industry developing. And when one day China understood that was also a powerful tool to bring the culture abroad, but not necessarily esteem from the Chinese government effort, right?
Yeah, I would say we can't just say in the binary of this is good or this is bad, you know, because when China's setting policy to limit the game or limit the teenagers from playing the game, well, it's a very powerful discourse to trying to say that education or study is much more important than playing, right? However, they do recognize that the game industry brings so much money into the country. So they do have to give this double narrative. Even they are contradicting themselves, they will still say, let's just keep the game industry on the one hand, but at the same time still having those hard policy on the teenagers should not play so much game, or you should not pay so much money to the game industry. So yeah, pretty conflictual, you know.
That's very interesting. And what are some of the key aspects of this process we should be paying attention on?
Yeah, so to talk about my current project or this thing that's slowly showing up in China right now, definitely the game industry is involved. This new term called Guochao. So it's a two-part word. Guo means the nation and Chao means the popular. So when you put those two together, it's already kind of contradictory, because you wouldn't put the initiative from the popular culture and the initiative from the state discourse together, right? But this is kind of what we are having in right now in China. Guochao basically means some initiative from the popular, either the popular culture or the popular products, and then it was adopted by the nation, and then it becomes a discourse either to, you know, make those products and cultural products and physical products into a collage and say, this is the phenomenon right now, or they can use all of those products and as a collage to say, this is who we are, our identity in the global atmosphere, to tell the West, this is who we are, see all of these products we have, and you just play those products, you just buy those products, and you just experience those products, you will see who the Chinese is. It produces a Chinese voice in the globe, right? But also it produces a state-oriented discourse inside of China, so that people understand, oh, when we are trying to create cultural product, this is kind of the general schedule or the agenda that we should follow, right? So it's a very much a Guochao is definitely both domestically important and internationally, globally important, because it helps Chinese producers and creators to follow along this, but also tell the West, this is who we are and this is the Chinese voice.
Kind of put like a framing into the game industry that was developing independently and now gets a new frame.
Right. I think you're onto a point, because say like the game industry by its own is very negative because it's violent, it's addictive, and was under Chinese policy. Now, if we create a new word called Guochao, it not only includes game industry, but also animation, films, and all of the other, cultural products and even physical products. Now the focus is how does this new term, this wave, is presenting, not who is game industry in China, right? And then you can kind of dodge those bullets of it's addictive or it's violent. You can just say, oh, this game is such a Guochao product, and it represents who we are, and it speaks Chinese voice. And you can kind of avoid all of those negativeness when you're talking about this. So yeah, I think, you know.
can you give us some examples of media examples of the Guochao wave? Mm-hmm. And what's unique about them compared to other media examples in the Chinese cultural industry?
Yeah, so currently, like I just I mentioned earlier, this game called Black Myth Wukong, right? So it's talking about, or in general, this game, the narrative is on this figure called Sun Wukong. He is a mythical figure, never existed, but was originally embedded in a demon god fiction called The Journey to the West. It's a very famous fiction. It was written in 16th century, actually. So it was a very old novel. And then this figure, Sun Wukong, especially was adopted over and over again in current day animations and fictions and now the games. So basically, this figure originally was portrayed as a, you know, furry looking monkey. So Sun Wukong is the name of this monkey. And he is so powerful that none of the gods and none of the emperors in the fiction, in the novel, can really handle him. But his dream in that, well, at least showing the 16th century fiction, his dream is trying to say he is useful to the society and he want to be recognized and want to contribute his force to the country. However, the fiction kind of lays out as because he's too powerful, so everyone wants to get a control on him instead of actually using him as a force. So it's kind of like a criticism from the author at that time saying that the author, he himself, is just like Sun Wukong, not being recognized even he is so talented. So then this figure in current-day China or in the past century was being adopted and rewritten into different kind of animations, different kind of games. And then the main theme shift a little bit from being recognized and want to use his talent into a rebellious figure. So if you see the animation or even the game today, Sun Wukong is basically a rebellious figure against some kind of grand regime or power. Could be referring to the domestic, but also sometimes, or not sometimes, most of times it's talking about the China as a new country after, you know, after the new 1949, the new China, want to stand up and trying to go against the imperial forces from the West. So Sun Wukong becomes a rebellious figure as China grows, Sun Wukong also grows. So today, when we see this game, Black Myth Wukong, Sun Wukong is basically, well, not exactly played by the player, but his kind of descendant is played by the players and trying to recollect pieces of spirit of Sun Wukong. And sorry, this is a spoiler to people who haven't played the game, so hopefully this is not really... Yeah. But this is spoiler alert. Yeah, so you're playing a descendant of Sun Wukong and trying to recollect his pieces, spirits, together, trying to revive him. But along the way, you are still fighting the imperial or the regime. At the time, it was kind of the reminiscence of the past, but it's kind of a new wave of power and regime and demons or monsters coming out, and you have to clear them in order to reclaim Sun Wukong back. So yeah, it's kind of a very rebellious game as compared to other recent rewriting of the figure Sun Wukong. So yeah.
Anything generates a feeling of identification with the character?
Yeah, totally. I would read a article, and the first sentence of the article is Sun Wukong is the most, if not the best, representation of Chinese identity in the recent history of animation or culture industry. So people really like to use this figure to say who we are and who we want to become, and what basically can we do?
And what do you think that generates on people that are not Chinese playing the game?
I know. I see some, you know, forums on, you know, Reddit or other social medias. And basically, the general theme is they express a interest in wanting to read Journey to the West, which is the original fiction that the game is based on. They will, because in some of them have heard of it, have seen Sun Wukong from Dragon Ball, because that's most likely where the Americans and the other European audience have heard this name. Of course, Dragon Ball was based on Sun Wukong from China as well. But many of them have not read the fictions. Many of them do not know who truly is. So after they play the game and see so much text and details embedded inside of the game, and they start to get curious of what is this fiction and what is this figure and how do we actually understand it. So most of them kind of express a impressiveness of how the Chinese tradition could be, and it was so old because many of them do not know that it was a 1600 or 16th century novel. So yeah.
So it kind of sparks a certain curiosity for the popular culture and the folklore of the country, understanding its mystical figures and the legacy of all these centuries. Interesting. And how what is the relationship of that with counter media? I know this is part of your research as well.
Yeah, so basically, if we're thinking about counter media, well, generally speaking, there is part of the part in one side, and there's part on the other side, and they go in conflicts, right? So usually one side is probably more powerful and express kind of control or coercion on the others, and then the other could be rebellious. So like I said, Sun Wukong, it was originally established. Or not originally. It was recently adopted as a rebellious figure. So if we think about this game, especially Black Myth Wukong, it is designed as a... Well, it's designed from a company that was pretty small. It's not the grand Chinese game industry. If you say the big names in the Chinese game industry right now, there's definitely Tencent, there's definitely NetEase, and also the company behind Genjin, which is my other project, miHoYo or HoYoVerse. Basically, those are the big names that the West and in general Chinese knows. However, Black Myth Wukong, as the first AAA games or as the first huge grand game in China, was actually developed by individual developers. So the team is kind of like just dozens of people. There's not a lot of people inside of that company. And if you go to their website and see what's their purpose of doing this game, they will usually say, they just want to express the Chinese culture. They want to express who they are as Chinese developers instead of trying to develop a game that just basically grab money from people, right? So, yeah, there are some very interesting grand themes they want to express as just a small developer. And if you think them as the peripheral of the Chinese game industry, because they are, and they are actually trying to counter the center of the game industry in China, because they would argue the center is basically trying to produce and reproduce games that's basically money-making machines instead of trying to express anything that's useful or anything that's educational or anything that's insightful for the players. So they want to break that, and of course they did.
It's interesting how we find that political spectrum in every industry, in every place we go. And how Wao Chao has also, you know, I understand it has shifted meaning over time. Mm-hmm. And how do you personally see it evolve and grow in the future?
Yeah, so I didn't kind of say this earlier, but in the articles or the journals we read, or I read, basically Guo Chao has changed over time. So originally speaking, it is, it is just called Guo Chao, and what it refers is a boost of physical products. For example, and there is, like, you know, there's alcohols that's collaborating with the historical sites in China, and there is candies, there's cosmetics that was also collaborating with, you know, the traditions, the fictions, the a kind of design and style. So originally, guochao basically means a boost in the aesthetics of designing and the aesthetics of the consumer products that's combining both the traditional Chinese culture and also kind of consumer products. And then there is a change slowly because they see the potential of this guochao. And currently, what we say guochao or new guochao, basically it's talking about the cultural products or, you know, the games, like I just said, the animation and the music, something more discursive or something more in the way of expression instead of like consumer products. And the state and also the popular culture think this is a better way to disseminate the products into others, because if you think the physical products, if the, you know, the Western consumers do not like to drink liquors in China, they will not buy the those stuff. However, if it's music, if it's animation, if it's a game, it's so much easier for people to take a hold onto it, buy it, or to play it, or to listen to it, and then understand, oh, there's some different style, aesthetics, and meaning behind those products, so they see the Chinese culture behind it. Yeah, so there is this shift first from the physical products of guochao into a cultural product of guochao, or the guochao and new guochao. And sorry, what's the second part of the question?
It's how do you personally see that evolve and growing in the future?
Yeah, well, I can only imagine, because we are still pretty much inside of this wave, and we are still seeing products coming out. We are still seeing new animation, game, and movie, and music coming out under this theme, and the collage of guochao has become larger and larger. So one can only expect it to be more powerful as a state discourse and also as a powerful, you know, Chinese voice in the globe. But is it going to be totally positive? I doubt it. Is it going to be totally negative? I doubt it too. So I think we can only experience it with it and see later.
Let me help me understand this process. Yeah. In terms of the, you mentioned that one of the most popular games in China and internationally right now was developed by a very small team.
Yep.
Outside the big game industry in China. And would you say the new guochao is empowering the smaller developers? How is the government in China aligning with the smaller projects or trying to pivot the large industry?
Maybe I can say an order example, because I would say the Black Myth Wukong's influence is still very much present right now. But if we go back 5 years, 6 years, when the game of Genjin coming out, it was at that time the company of HoYoverse was a small company 5 years ago. However, they slowly adopt a lot of guochao kind of themes into the games. At that time, it was not called guochao. Guochao is a very recent term that was coined. But at that time, when the for example, the Genjin, they involve a opera, Beijing opera singer into the game and start to align the in-game characters with this Beijing opera, which is a Chinese tradition and ways of singing. And then it just suddenly becomes so popular, not only domestically, but also to the Western players, seeing this wonderful music from China they have never heard of, but beautifully embedded within a game. So as a gamer, when you play it, you naturally experience it, and then you see how interesting or impressive the Chinese culture is. And then HoYoverse at that time, 2020, 2018, 2017, was a very small company grow, and now it's becoming one of the big head in the Chinese game industry. So there is a change of a small company become larger. So I actually do not know if Black Myth Wukong will actually, or the developer of Black Myth Wukong would take advantage of this game and see themselves becoming larger and growing and slowly become a dominant force in China, or assimilate themselves into more of a bigger Chinese game industry. it could happen. But right now, because we are still in the process of the influence under this game just coming out last year, right? So we have not seen the move of the game, the company, but very much they could just become the second holdovers or make themselves as the big name in China gaming industry. So,
and with that, not only grow economically, but impact the cultural adherence to the new policies and the framework.
Of course, yeah. And just another anecdote, when the Beijing Opera was involved in the Genshin Impact, the Chinese New Year Gala, I don't know what's exactly the name of it. I think it's Spring Festival Gala, which is kind of a celebration once a year during the New Year, Chinese New Year, or the Spring Festival. There is like a show on the CCTV, which is the Chinese Central Television, broadcasting to the whole Chinese audience of the celebration. And at that time, they actually involved this Beijing Opera in Genshin Impact in that gala, which has never happened in 30-year history of that gala. That was the first time they actually involved a game theme directly into the gala and broadcasting it to the Chinese audience. So you can see the state is actually kind of approving it, but of course it's ignoring the negativeness of it. It's just only including that very specific part of the singing to say that this is the Chinese culture, this is the game, what can do with the Chinese culture. But other things, we're not going to talk about it.
Majorly, it would be helpful for the video games to spark that curiosity back to religion if they are letting that go. Because at least I feel, being Brazilian myself, it's a complex thing in the country about religion and younger generations. Mm-hmm. But for a long time, youth have detached themselves from dogmas and religious expectations. I wonder how that happened in China and if there is a role to be played with the video games sparking that curiosity in spirituality and religious traditions.
I think that's a wonderful question because from that interdisciplinary field of the with religion and video game, the first argument or the theme they're trying to demystify is basically there is nothing that religion and video game cannot get together. They can always get together and they actually merge or converge very well. But it just, there is a very powerful role of video game, I would say, because as a popular culture or as something that when people say they're playing a game, it's always for leisure or it's also always not work. And whenever they see some, you know, trace of religion or themes of religion involving the game, they will always change their mind saying, oh, this is not real, or this is fine. This is just me basically in a game trying to, you know, pray or trying to go to church or trying to, you know, see all of this different worshiper, but it means nothing to me in the real life. However, the scholars in this field will always say there is always a connection because you can't just imagine something out in a video game that's not have some trace or based on the reality, right? So there's always an interesting conflict there religion in video games is very common, and religious themes and religious narrative in games are very common, but nobody take it seriously. It's very interesting phenomenon. So this in China will be very much, you know, a common sense for both developers and players to understand that, for example, Black Myth Wukong is so heavily talking about Buddhism. It's everything in there. It's talking about Buddhism because the fiction, The Journey to the West, is based on complementing Buddhism's role in the society and trying to downplay the Taoism's role in the society. So the game is very much still inheriting that positiveness of Buddhism or positiveness of some kind of religion will be helpful. Some kind of faith or belief will be helpful. However, when the state actually seeing this or when the player is playing this, especially in China, not here. I know Western players are probably different, but in China, at least when they are seeing this, they will say, oh, it's just part of Chinese culture. There's nothing wrong with Buddhism inside of a video game. So the conflicts or the split there is very interesting, yeah.
But in terms of the non-Chinese audience, people playing the game, it does give some exposure, even if you're not converting people based on a video game. It seems to give exposure to different traditions that are completely different from the predominant religious in the West. So it gives that exposure to different types of spirituality.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody playing the Black Myth Wukong and saying, oh, there's so much Buddhism exposure in the game and I love it and I'm learning so much scriptures and cultures in the Buddhism right now. I think that will be very common to see.
It seems this field is young and very much focused on institutional religious. And how do you imagine Chinese traditions and religious play a part in this field?
Yeah, basically, the field is young because there's only so much big names in it. I don't know if you know Heidi Campbell, if you know Gregor Grieve, those are very much related to this school as well. But yeah, they have read a lot of stuff in the past 10 years, but there's not too much people or too much scholar actually trying to get involved into this field and trying to write more. So not surprisingly, I've never read one single article in this field trying to talk about what's the Chinese religious role in the game or how do we understand Chinese religion inside of video games. Yeah, so should I do it? Maybe. I mean, it's probably inevitably I will write about some part of how does religion function in the video games, or is this institutional, or is it just popular culture, or is it just becoming so much of a common sense in Chinese, among Chinese players or among the state instead of actually institutional, like a church here in the U.S. But yeah, I'm in media studies and I'm learning much more culture studies and critical studies people, I think those people like Stuart Hall and Edward Said will be very helpful to my work instead of like citing too much of the religious studies scholars because in my opinion, they are very much limited themselves in institutional and Western Enlightenment religion, for example, Christianity, most likely. So when you're trying to adopt their frame and saying how does Chinese religion and culture fit into it, it's limited. And I don't think it's very much helpful to say the implication or the significance of Chinese religion and traditions in their frame. I will have to create a new framework to say how does Chinese religion play a part. Yeah.
It's also to say and to explain how a small group of developers created a framework, a game that became so popular, right? And what are the forces and the influences playing a role in this development?
Oh, I mean, I could also kind of just give a sense of there's always when you say the game is successful, right? There is always the forces from the players because you see the sales number, right? You see how much sales of this game has accomplished to say this game is successful, right? So that means players have paid it and developers have contributed so much time and effort into it. And there is the awarding ceremony or the platforms trying to give out awards and trying to recognize this game is good, right? So when we say it's successful or when we say it's outreaching, it's always a very multi-party effort. It's not just like, oh, there's a simple standard of what is the successfulness of video games. So yeah, I think it's very important to recognize that different parties play a role into building up this phenomenon instead of just saying, oh, it's just a game or, oh, it's so many people playing it, so it's successful. Yeah. Including Chinese culture and tradition into game is not new. It's not like because of Guochao and people are doing it. 20 years ago when Chinese video games are not so popular or so international, the first instant when developers trying to create games, the first place they go to is actually Chinese culture and traditions. So 20 years ago, there's already a lot of good games on Chinese culture. It just, I think the change of Guochao is basically, at that time, 20 years ago, when developers are doing video games on Chinese culture, they did not expect players from the West play it. So the language in the game is very much only understandable to Chinese players. So that's why I feel it's not disseminating. You know, the game is not circulating because people do not understand the language you're talking about. Not just translations, but also, you know, so much reference and so much the Chinese culture at that time. So players in China will totally understand the memes and the language. However, you cannot expect people from the West to understand. For example, there's wuxia or there's xianxia, which is basically themes of the games that's involving a lot of traditional fictions in China, but also a new reform and opening up kind of ways of language. So I think Guochao, what's different of Guochao is actually they give not only a port for the games to put themselves in, but also a language that the West can understand.
In how you compare other past efforts through other mediums, other forms of media, music, cinema, movies, to spread the message compared to video games, because it seems to me, of course, people of every age can play video games, and they do, but I would say more predominantly it's something that younger generations do. What do you think is the role to play in this specific type of media compared to other forms?
Yeah, at first I think, well, definitely Guochao is not only about video games, right? It's about all kind of popular culture. I think game is unique here is because many aspects, but at least on top of my head, people, when they are playing the games, they know this is simulation. They know this is not reality. Of course, video game as a simulation is not new. People have known or have talked about the realness of video games. But I think there is just so much directions for games to be explored. For example, in the academia, when we are talking about video games, there is always two parties. First one talking about the playfulness of the video games, and then the second part talking about the narratives of video games. And there is always a third party saying, why you separate them? It's connected in a game. You cannot just say a game without narrative is a game, or the game without players is a game. So video games is so unique because even in just now I was talking about the game study scholars, right? But in the participatory culture scholars, when they are seeing video games, they see something different because in movies or in films or music, the audience are passive in the way that they can only receive the message. They cannot directly reply. They could go to social media and reply to the music, but they cannot just say like, when they're listening to music, they adding a verse into that music and change the whole music. They cannot do that in game. They could. They actually could. Each player, when they're playing the game, it's a new set of the games. Even the game narratives and the game styles and the stories are exactly the same. People playing it will present you different scenarios. And there's always bugs, which in the game basically means there's something unexpected happening. And almost always when players are playing it, there's something unexpected, not in the coding language of the game, will happen. And that gives a creativity of the players to play differently. And there is a different style of studying it, because now you see the player as a participant at that moment of playing, instead of saying I listen to music and then I go to social media and reply to this music. In that scenario, there is a lag, right? There is a time difference between your listening to it and your replying to it.
Yeah. And the posture, right? Yes. Like from a passive to a more active role in the development of the medium.
Yeah.
And also I would say it's also a little bit more unexpected, unexpected, because we, as a society, we have learned that historically movies and in the movie industry in particular, and radio have been used as a tool and as a vehicle for propaganda, yeah, for spreading messages. Yeah. But the video game seems to be a more a novel and unexpected way.
It could definitely go both ways. Yeah, it could definitely be a propaganda, or it could be a creative project that go against propaganda. So,
but as a medium that spreads a message, yeah, as something that is communicating to, yeah, the audience something, either if it's Chinese values or any other political aspect of it, it's just a more more innovative way to sending, right, a message to the world.
Yeah. Basically, when players playing it, like I said earlier, they're not thinking they are playing a political message. But afterward, or even during the play, they could just like see something and instantly reflecting like, oh, this is something I recognize. Oh, this is something I have seen other place. Oh, this is some message I have seen in the news. And then they start to connect life into the playing. And then it might even alter their very next decision in the game when they're playing. So it's very instant. It's at that moment. There's no lagging in their response and they're receiving the message.
Fascinating. I'm very interested. And just as a last question, I just I'm kind of curious because I know you're also learning how to code and getting to the gaming industry yourself. So I'm interested in the interface of your practical work and, yeah, your academic work.
Actually, a lot of people have asked me, you're coding and you are learning coding language. Specifically, I'm learning with my friend right now in China and on this software called Game Maker, basically a 2D game making engine. And I have to actually put codes in there for the characters to move and to collide or to attack. A lot of people have asked me, how are you going to use this in your research, right? And to be honest, I'm working step by step, so I have no idea what is this going to be helping me in the future. But right now, I think, first of all, I'm just finishing my first year, and I have some time to learn a new skill. And then I think, I do have a lot of friends in China who are just game designers. They are not scholars at all. And always, when we are having a conversation, they are asking me, tell me something I know, or tell me something I'm interested. And whenever I heard that question, I started to give them articles. I started to give them terms and concepts I learned in academia. And they said, this is not what I'm interested. I want to know something more about the industry, about players, about developers, about the politics around it. I don't want to hear things that's talking about the game language or the concept. So I feel at least learning this skill will give me a entry point to connect to them better. And I will understand what they are thinking about. I will understand their questions and what they want to solve better. As a scholar, again, I don't know if that's going to help in my writing, but at least it will give me connection to them. And when I'm interviewing them or when I'm
exposure.
And interning with their company or even just give me job opportunity in the future, right? I think this is helpful in multiple ways. And I will have to explore more.
Thank you. I'm sure you're going to find your ways of entangling the practical experience and developing the games with your reflections. I really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You have been listening to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks all the questions about new technology, coming to you from the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and is produced by Alexander Lipka. You can find us on the fourth Thursday of every month on air or online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month. Thank you for listening.